and you are listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me today on this October 23rd, 2012. How are you? I'm doing pretty well, and I'm glad you're joining me today. We've got a very interesting program lined up, and I know I'm going to be learning quite a bit. But before we get started, I wanted to remind you, for those of you who are familiar with my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living Real, we're in our October fun drive. We're calling it the Real Virtual Pancake Breakfast Fundraiser, and you can go to our website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can download the sourdough cornmeal vegan gluten-free pancake recipe and have a good time with it. And also make a donation if you are so moved, because we could really use it. And we're doing lots of wonderful things for the planet with this organization. Thanks for your support in advance. responsibleeatingandliving.com. All right. My first guest is Tom Reagan. He is universally recognized as the intellectual leader of the animal rights movement. During his more than 30 years on the faculty of North Carolina State University, he received numerous awards for excellence in undergraduate and graduate teaching, was named University Alumni Distinguished Professor, published hundreds of professional papers and more than 20 books, won major international awards for film writing and direction, and presented hundreds of lectures throughout the United States and abroad. Upon his retirement in 2001, he received the William Quarles Holiday Medal, the highest honor North Carolina State University can bestow on one of its faculty. His wife, Nancy, and he co-founded the Culture and Animals Foundation. Welcome to It's All About Food.
Oh, it's my honor to be on your show. Thank you.
No. The honor is all mine. In fact, I was so honored when I first got to meet you earlier this year, and I'm so glad I did. Of course, it was kind of a bittersweet experience, as you may remember. We both went to the memorial of Marty Keel, who was a phenomenal author and activist.
She was a wonderful person.
And a wonderful person. And I want to say that I was fortunate to meet her shortly before she left this life. And the wonderful thing about that memorial was all of us who gathered afterwards. It was really a wonderful experience to be together with so many people who share the same dream of making this world a better, more kinder place.
Yeah, it was an inspiration to me, I can tell you, and to Nancy as well. We went home fueled with the compassion that we experienced at this memorial service and also at the table. So we were the better for having gone there.
Yeah, I agree. And inspiration is something that all of us need to get continually, because it's so easy to lose focus, be depressed, and because we're continually focusing on what is wrong. And
well, that's an astute observation, I think. The movement goes forward despite the people who leave it every day, because they're dispirited, because they're impatient, because they give up hope. And so it's like a revolving door. People come in and people go out. And our first obligation to the animals and to the earth is to stay in the movement, to keep making a contribution in our several ways, in our separate ways. But the enemy wins if we
go out the door. That's right. Have to stay with it and stay fueled and stay inspired. I like to keep things as positive as I possibly can, and we'll be focusing on both the good and the bad and hopefully leave with a lot of good. So if somebody saw you walking down the street, I don't think that they would think, oh, that's an animal rights activist.
And no, I don't think so either.
I don't think so. Now, the unfortunate thing is there are many stereotypes around the world for many different kinds of people and kinds of characters, and the animal rights activist is no different. There is a stereotype. I don't think it's true. There might be a smattering of people who fit whatever the stereotype may be, but you're a lovely, friendly, kind, soft-spoken, intelligent person.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but yeah, I mean, I think that, of course, the public's image of an animal rights advocate is what the media feeds them, and mm-hmm. the media loves a plane crash. The media loves vandalism and violence. Just look at the front page of any newspaper in the world, and you'll confirm that for yourself. So our great struggle is to get past the media, so to speak. And the way we do that is by the example of our life. Everybody makes a contribution to the struggle just by being compassionate in their life. And we must never forget that, because the animals and the planet depend on us for their safety and for their survival. Mm-hmm. So we must not abandon them. That's our first obligation.
People may or may not realize, I just want to briefly continue on the media concept, that what we see very often in mainstream media is the sensational, the violent, and we have so many great editing capabilities today that people don't even realize when they're watching maybe some live coverage or something, very often a picture is spliced into it and may not even be from that event, but it's there to give us some subliminal thoughts and guide us along one direction, and we don't even realize very often what's happening.
No, I think you're correct about that. I mean, I'm not a keen student of the modern media, but I do know that subliminal messages can be placed in out of context.
Yeah, it happens.
Sure.
Yeah, it happens all the time. All right, just quick little history: how you got to where your thinking is today, and what inspired you to write your animal rights books.
Well, actually, the thing that I was a butcher when I was in college. I sliced, I diced, I minced, I ground. Mm. And as I've said in the past, their cold flesh gave way to my cruel will. I mean, the pieces of meat that I was working with might as well have been blocks of wood. I was so distant from any kind of identification or any kind of the spark of compassion. Not that I was intentionally cruel to the companion animals in my life. They were always special. But the other animals were like blocks of wood mm-hmm. to me. And it may have stayed that way in my life, except for the head and the heart. The head was I was involved in the anti-war movement, and I, in the Vietnam period, my wife Nancy and I founded the North Carolinians Against the War, a statewide grassroots organization. I thought, I'm a trained philosopher, I should be able to make a contribution, a philosophical contribution, to the anti-war movement. And I remember this as clear as if this happened yesterday. I was in the university library and I took down a book, and it was by an author whose name I recognized, but I had never read anything by him. And his name, the title of the book was My Experiments with Truth, and it was written by Mohandas K. Gandhi, mm-hmm. better known as Mahatma Gandhi. And Gandhi had an enormous influence on me. Basically, he said, not that he literally said this, I wasn't hallucinating, but it was as if he said to me from the pages of his work, I understand, Professor Reagan, that you're against unnecessary violence, and I said, yes, that's why I'm campaigning against the war. And he said, well, what are those dead body parts doing in your freezer then? And that was like a lightning bolt of thought. Of course, these animals met a violent end, and I was living my life according to my commitment to nonviolence, and there were dead body parts in my freezer. And that was an enormous, had an enormous influence on me. And then secondly, the hard matter was when we had a dog who was hit and died, and hit by a car and died because of someone's irresponsibility. And it just awoke in my heart, in the sense that I thought, if any other dog was in my life as this dog had been, I would have felt just as bad, just as hurt, just as sorrowful. And then it was a short step for me to say, but by golly, if I had knew a pig as well, or a cow as well, or a chicken as well, I would have felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And the loss of this creature. So it was a combination of the head, my thought with Gandhi, and the heart with the death of a dear friend. So, and then that was 40 years ago when that happened. So we've seen a lot of water go over the dam, and since then.
Yeah, well, now
that's how I got interested.
Yeah, it's a good story, and I always think it's important to tell the individual stories, because we all relate so much more, and we're so overwhelmed with the numbers. You know, we hear 60 billion land animals, plus or minus a few billion, are killed every year around the world. That's just an overwhelming number. But when we can look into the eyes of a hog, or look into the eyes of a cow or a chicken, I think it's a very different thing to see the individual personality and the life.
Well, the thing is that to my way of thinking, over time has really become simplified. There are some bodies, there are not some things. They're the subject of a life, not a life without a subject. The other animals they're in the world, they're aware of the world, they're aware of what happens to them, and what happens to them matters to them because it makes a difference in the duration and the quality of their life. And in this respect, they are fundamentally the same as you and I. And so it is that, from my perspective, we should not do to them what we would not have done to us. And it's really the application of the golden rule. We don't want to turn them into meat, turn them into clothes, turn them into competitors, turn them into performers, turn them to tools in laboratories. We wouldn't want that done to us. And so, given our subjective equality, we should not be doing that to them. It's really very simple to me.
Yeah, it's simple to me too, and it's so hard to find the ways to get that message across to as many people as we can. It's amazing how difficult it is. We live in a very violent world. We're violent very often to the people around us, whether we know them or not. We're violent to the earth in many ways, We exploit so many things, people, animals, resources. It's just kind of part of human nature.
Well, it does seem to be, for sure. I think that our mind is tickled by the violence that we see around us. It's almost an act of will to keep the true violence alive in one's mind rather than to deny it or to bury it or to forget it or whatever. It's very important to keep our sense of violence in the world alive. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you see a bunch of tens of thousands of chickens in a battery hen house, and you don't see the violence, you don't see what's being done to these animals, then you're really not living in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our obligation to keep our sense of violence alive in our life. Not that we practice it, but that we are aware of it, aware of what others do not see. That's the case. They don't see it. What's being done.
Yeah. There's horrible things going on every day all around the world. And I remember when September 11th, 2001 occurred, many of us were feeling it because it was so close to home, especially here in New York City. And
yeah.
One of the things that I kept saying to everyone I possibly could was, you're feeling overwhelmed. We don't know what to do. The thing that we can do is get the violence out of our own lives.
Yeah.
And we do that by what we eat and the products we use.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. You know, there's an image I sometimes use when I'm giving talks, and it's what I call the web of evil. And you say you have this picture of this enormous, complicated web. And as long as we're alive, we're going to be someplace in that web. We're going to be imperfect creatures in an imperfect world. We're going to contribute to the evil that is being done, either by actively or passively accepting it. But what we can struggle to do is to get as far from the center of the web as we can, to get because that's where the people who are perpetrators or viewers of evil don't recognize that the evil they do or see.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people in the center of the web, and we have to struggle as best we can to get as far from that center as we can. Well, knowing that we're not going to be perfect in any way, shape, or form, we're just going to be limited creatures in an imperfect world. But we can make a difference by trying to get away from the center.
Right. Now,
the other thing, there's another image, if I may.
Yes, please.
I sometimes picture this enormous wall that represents the oppression of other sentient life and the ecosystems and so on. And, of course, what we would like to do is to bring that wall down all at once and collapse and whatever. But if we're honest with ourselves, we know we can't do that. But what we can do is we can take the wall down a brick at a time. And that takes enormous stamina and courage and hard work and so on, just to take one brick down, just to end greyhound racing in Texas, or just to get chimps out of laboratories. It's just one brick, but it takes an enormous amount of time and effort.
It does, and I fight that whole, you're right about this brick concept, but I always try to get people to see the whole picture, to see the whole wall.
yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah,
and
it's hard.
We're so used to seeing some things that we no longer see them. We're so used to seeing animal abuse in factory farms and in laboratories and in marine display. We're so insensitive to that because it's a part of our daily diet. in the world. But that's why we have to, some the people listening to your radio show, we all have to keep our sense of anger alive in response to the evil that people don't see.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned to me this war analogy. Could we just talk about a little bit about that?
Yeah, because when people try to find an analogy, the two most common ones are the slavery analogy and the Holocaust analogy.
Right.
And the slavery analogy has a point, up to a point, but it seems to break down when we think about it was normally in the interest of slave owners not to kill their slaves.
Mm.
But it is in the interest of hog farmers to kill their hogs.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this analogy there. And in the Holocaust analogy, there was, the Holocaust, the purpose of the Holocaust was to exterminate various groups of people, homosexuals, Jews, Seventh-day Adventists, I think there were, but to obliterate them, to take them off the face of the earth. But that's normally not what happens when humans dominate other animals. I mean, it may sometimes happen, but rarely, it's the exception, not the rule. And again, mm-hmm. think about what's in the interest of furriers and in the interest of hog pork producers is to have more animals to be exploited rather than exterminate them. So I've been thinking about, well, what is a better analogy? And I it's the war analogy, like you've mentioned. It's the idea that what are the characteristics of wars? Well, individuals are injured, they're killed, they're imprisoned, and weapons are used. And if we think about how animals are exploited,
mm-hmm.
for example, in animal agriculture, they are imprisoned.
Definitely.
They are injured. They are killed. And weapons are used. Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, they'll say, well, we use tools. We use stereotactic devices and rat guillotines or something. But they are, once you adopt the war analogy, that kind of thinking, you say, no, they're weapons. That's what they are. They're weapons used by the perpetrators of the war. Then the other thing about it is that this seems to put all the blame on the people who are directly exploiting the animals, and the consumer gets off scot-free. But no, if you think about war again, there's a group of people called mercenaries. And mercenaries are people who are paid to wage the war. And in the United States, the war and for our independence from Great Britain, their Hessians were used. But that's what we do. We pay people to carry out the war on our behalf. If we're meat eaters, if we're use cosmetics that have been tested on animals and wear fur and all the rest of that, we are paying people to carry out the war. That's what a consumer is, a consumer of those products. That's what that consumer is.
Our hands are not clean.
No. For sure. And at the same time, it's just so very important. I remember an experience that I had where a person came up after I gave a talk, and they said to me, "Well, what about plants?" And this woman who was with me, a very accomplished philosopher, just went ballistic. She said, "I've heard this question 1,000 times, and I've got it." And she stormed off in a huff. And then later, she came back to me and she said, "I have to apologize. I'm so disappointed in my behavior, but I really have heard this question 1,000 times." And I said to her, in an uncommon moment of insight on my part, I think, but I said to her, "Yes, but that was the first time that person asked me that question."
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to remember, that people can't hear you when you're shouting at them.
That's right.
It's a paradox, but they can't hear you when you're shouting at them. That's why Gandhi, part of the reason Gandhi had such a profound impact on my life was because he was so meek of a man, and yet so tough and
yes.
resilient
yes.
and committed. He won his country's independence.
Yep.
You can imagine that. This man who, when he died, had a dhoti, a pair of sandals, some glasses,
mm-hmm.
and a bull.
Mm-hmm.
Those were, he brought down the might of the British Army.
With nothing but his own integrity.
Yeah.
Yeah, very powerful.
So he's still an inspiration to me.
We just have a few minutes, and I wanted to talk about the animal welfare versus animal rights debate. Is that a brick versus wall scenario?
Yeah, I guess. No, not quite. There are incremental abolitionist steps you can take. You can end greyhound racing. You can end cosmetic testing. You can end toxicity testing. You can end dog labs, for example, as PCRM has successfully done. So there are abolitionists. It's not that, like, you're just reforming a practice and keeping it and making it more welfare respecting, but you are actually ending things. So you have to, I give a list of those sorts of campaigns in my book, Empty Cages. But I think, from my point of view, as long we view other animals as a culture, as our resources, and welfare reforms simply makes it more acceptable that we view other animals as our resources.
Right.
Because they're treated better, they can turn around, they can whatever, but they're still our resources.
Yeah.
And so I'm opposed to welfare reforms because they don't really address the problem, and at the same time it makes meat consumption more socially acceptable.
Yeah.
For example,
everybody pats themselves on the back saying, okay, we're doing a good thing, we're giving a little bigger cage to the chickens, but there's really no improvement at all.
No, that's why I've always said not larger cages, empty cages.
Empty cages.
I mean, that's the thing. Where empty cages means there's no animal who's our resource in that cage, and that's what we want to get there. So, and I don't think we do get there by making welfare reforms.
Okay, so you've been at this animal rights thing for a bunch of decades. Are we making headway?
Well, in some ways we are, in some ways we aren't. And in terms of body count, I mean, in 1975, when I published my first The Moral Basis of Vegetarianism, there was roughly 6 billion animals destroyed in the United States, and today there are in excess of 10 billion animals. Mm. So in terms of body count, no, we're going in the opposite direction, I would guess. But in terms, in other terms, I mean, when I retired from the university, they presented me with the highest honor, and they also invited me to establish the Tom Reagan Animal Rights Archive at the university library. I don't think that was thinkable when we started in 1972 or so. I don't think that was thinkable. It was impossible.
Yeah.
And if you look at the growth of academic courses in literature and in philosophy and law and sociology and anthropology and biology and so on, there was a point when we were, if you think of a university as a castle, that we were outside the moat. Now we're inside the castle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really is an amazing turn of events, an amazing change. And
we're definitely inside the castle, and I wanted to mention we have publications like LA Weekly saying that vegan is mainstream. I was reading this online beefmagazine.com with a blog post recently that said vegan and vegetarian is mainstream, and I don't know that it's mainstream, but we're in the castle.
We are in the castle, right? We're not outside the moat.
That's right. So people can hear us, and that's a good thing. Okay, the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is your favorite foods.
Oh, pasta, pasta, pasta.
He's a pasta guy. Okay.
I am the luckiest person on the... I'm like Lou Gehrig. I'm the luckiest person on the face of the earth. Because my wife is a marvelous cook, and
Nancy Reagan, we love her name.
Yeah. I always say I'm married to Nancy Reagan, and it's been the best of times and the worst of times to be married to Nancy Reagan. So, but yeah, I'm blessed. I haven't done anything to deserve it. That she's a committed chef, and she loves the challenge of making wonderful vegan food, and she basically makes everything fresh. So
that's the way to do it. Thank you for joining me so much on It's All About Food, Tom. I look forward to seeing you and Nancy again and enjoying some wonderful plant food.
Oh, let's look forward to the day.
That's right. Thank you again.
Again, I'm honored to be on it,
okay.
On your program.
Thank you for everything you've done. Empty Cages, A Case for Animal Rights, all of your great writing. You have made a great difference on this planet. Thank you.
Oh, I hope so. I hope I've made some, anyhow.
Okay. Be well. Thank you. And we're going to take a quick break. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Stay with us. I will be right back with Ricky Heller. We're going to talk about allergy-free desserts and candida and all kinds of fun stuff.